This is a Collider.com audio interview.
We should make a movie that was racist to begin with, and the conception behind remaking it, this iconic movie.
It was timely, and we got the technology, you know? I mean, Harryhausen's work was sort of seen at the time. That was it. That was as good as claymation gets. And there was the move then into models and to digital. And the original Clash of the Titans, which was strands of Greek mythology woven together by Beverly Cross for that movie, pulled together so many forces that it was deemed a property ripe for a remake, you know, if ever there was. What makes a remake and why would you do something again? You know, is it different cast, is it different director, different angle on it? Well, clearly with our mythological creatures, the realm of visual effects is clearly going to give it a different look. And the property sat there, the intellectual property rights sat with Warner Brothers. And Basil, the other producer on the show, had it for some time. It had gone through a couple of incarnations. And then the studio saw Louis' work on The Hulk. He came together, and as well you know, a movie's like a snowball. It needs a momentum, and it needs a push, and it needs many things to happen. The confluence as to why a movie happens, I'm sure people have written many a thesis on. Louis came on board, I came on board at the same time. Used to putting together movies in difficult places with international logistics, that sort of thing. And then Sam came on board, and at this point, our timing was disastrous, simply in that we were trying to up the budget of a movie while there was a world recession going on. That's not good. But we're here, so we succeeded.
You mentioned the property rights here. Why is it important to do Clash of the Titans rather than Greek mythology called in the movie?
It's not. to be honest, I mean, there are property rights to Greek mythology, I think, sort of, they're not there. But Clash of the Titans was a treatment of mythology that brought together all these different characters. And that, as a structure, is appealing. You know what I mean? You're starting from something there. And there's the sense of the remake, you're buying that skeleton. The flesh of the skeleton, like all of us here, is completely different.
So it's the structure and the copyright.
Yeah.
Would it be fair to say that the original Clash of the Titans, while well-loved, is a film where you look at it and you go, that could do with a bit of polish. That could do with a bit of a nip here and a tuck.
When did you see the original last Clash of the Titans?
About 2 days ago.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Got a bit of fat on it. Yeah, a lot of dawdling. A lot of Burgess Meredith.
Come on. Come on.
In its time, that was a quality. Do you know what I mean? And I think you do look at these things and you know, that there is the phrase, a contemporary take on something, you know, and I think that's, you know, you look at gangster movies and it is a film does have the ability to go back into its own history and do a different take on it, and that take is for the generation, you know what I mean? So there are our timeless movies, and there are the movies of our childhood that we thought were the coolest thing ever, and upon revisiting them, there's like, oh, really? I thought that was cool. And same with our wardrobes.
Looking at the sizzle reel, there's a lot of great exterior shots, there's a lot of the sun very low in the sea, there's a lot of that rosy finger of a dawn feeling. Was the Odyssey a big influence, like a man on a mission plot making it a larger group? Was the Odyssey an actual influence?
No, other than it lurked in the background. I think that what you saw on that sizzle reel, you put your finger on, first of all, was something that hooked me into the project, was there was a decision, a fundamental decision made very, very early on, was that we were not going to go down the route of green screen and composite digital landscapes. That our 200 BC mythological world, you could snort it, you could put your foot in it. It had to be real. And for me, that was an attraction, because internationally, that's what I like doing, is accessing locations and setting up countries and things that the audience hasn't been to before, as best one can. So we made a decision not to go, as it is known, because it is so successful, the 300 route. We didn't go the route of we'll create this fantastical world and we'll do the green screens. Now we use the expression of the 300 route because theirs was, you know, the finest rendition of that particular way of making a film, deservedly so. So we wanted to go forth into the real world, and that was something, you know, I used to work as a location manager and work with some of the finest designers in the world and directors who shoot locations extremely well. So, you know, set up movies like Private Ryan and The Beach Invasion and The Last Samurai, those sort of things. So, you know, I wear boots. still. So that was something that I wanted to do, and that was something that Louis wanted to do. So what you saw in that sizzle reel, you saw locations predominantly from the Canary Islands, because it's the first 6 weeks of photography. What you did not see there is the stuff that we did in Wales, in great slate mines and quarries and underground tunnels going into the core of those mountains. And in 3 weeks, 4 weeks' time, I'm off to Ethiopia, to the Danakil Depression, which is a war zone near the Sudan, which National Geographic have filmed there, and one or two of those sort of things. And we're taking Clash of the Titans into that area. Bright yellow, sulfur-filled lakes and active volcanoes to give this film, you know, not only grit, but also epic. You know, it's anamorphic. The big landscapes are very important. The world in which they're going and inhabiting should take your breath away.
I want to ask about the timing, because this movie is already scheduled to come out in March.
Yes.
And it's kind of interesting because there's a lot of movies like coming out next summer, which finished filming months ago. And I was curious about the timing of actually being able to still shoot in a few weeks and be able to finish it.
Well, you're curious. I'm panicked. Yeah, it's
a very tight schedule to be slowly shooting.
You're absolutely right. It is. It was a target that we were set, and it was a precondition to doing the movie. So it's been very tough on Louis. It's been tough on all departments. We're in production and we're in post-production parallel, which places huge pressures on everyone, because, you know, we're fighting to get time to work out how we're doing things, to test rigs, to do all the stuff that you do to make a movie. And the director at the weekends is not only editing the movie, but he's also deciding on where a Medusa will be in the frame, you know, and houses are having to commit. Now, normally that post-production period would not only be much longer, but it would be somewhat discreet from the process of shooting the movie. Yeah, we're doing production and post-production contemporaneously, and have been since, believe it or not, the end of May.
Can you talk about contemporizing the movie for a contemporary audience? What does that mean exactly? I mean, more action, more creature?
If you go back and look at any of these older movies, there's a sense of the actors are carrying the social structure of the time of the movie was shot. And every now and again, if you can ever do it, you can see movies that break that mold. Well, they did, as you said, with the Burgess Meredith stuff, and those moments, those single shots of, by the gods, worked then, because in that period, that was acceptable. And that was acceptable force to drive a narrative along. It isn't now. And so our actors inhabit a more contemporary version of it, although against a mythological background.
Well, in terms of what works in a movie, apart from the acting style, it's got to be bigger, or does it have to have more whiz-bang effects? Does it got more action? Was that the mandate going in?
No mandate. The directors take on the project, which was considered important, and Warner's studio is a great studio for directors to take and realize their visions. It's a good environment.
When I was a young lad, we watched Clash of Titans over and over and over again. It was one of our absolute favorites, and we talked about it all the time regarding like different set pieces. You know, we loved the part where the statue of the head would talk and this thing would happen. And I'm wondering how tied you felt to recreating certain set pieces from the original, where you knew you could, you know, maybe we don't need to do that one, but we have to do this one. I mean, obviously you need the Kraken, you need Medusa, but what did you need from the original? How did that process?
It wasn't a comparative sheet. We took the main thrusts of the story and took certain, for instance, the scorpions in the original are minor. In ours, we've developed that form a lot more. So we didn't do it we like this, we'll make that big. We actually went and said, okay, we know all the characters, and then we'll take the story and then let that develop. So there was no intertextual comparison or weight going on. There will be moments in this movie that will be more outstanding than in that. You know, let that have its life. We've taken a lot of the characters and developed them clearly, you know, lines like kill the Kraken and things like that. All those are very, very important lines, and those characters are there. But we have characters such as the Harpies that are ours. They're ours, they're what we've put in, and our Scorpiox, to pay to the Scorpions, are much stronger a feature. The two will stand autonomously, although there will be parallels.
One of the things about the original Clash is really interesting is that it's just the one movie. And I know the correct answer is we're going to make the movie and see how it does, but is there a thought of saying, here's this big mythological world, you know, it's the 21st century, we love franchises, you know, are there more adventures to be had in this world?
Yes. Quite simply, yes. I mean, if the audience of storytelling, the whole thing works, then clearly there are survivors and there are deaths in this movie. But the whole world of mythology is there to be explored. And I think what will be interesting is the reception of our treatment of mythology with our slightly distinctive look. I mean, you look at the armor, you look at the costumes, you can see that it is based upon history. But you can also see there's a slight twist to it. It's not overt, but there's a slight twist there. And if that slight twist, if that all comes together, it's going to meld into a movie that, without doubt, there are other avenues of mythology that this group could go to. And Perseus did, through the mythological world, go on several journeys. And without a doubt, there is the potential there, the strong potential.
Kind of follow up to what I was asked before. One of the things about the original, the Ray Harryhausen's kind of stop motion, which you just look at now. Now you look at it, it looks kind of cheesy. You don't see the movie now, but I mean, there's some kind of charm to it, which I think people would love the movie.
Correct.
Kind of like that. I mean, is there any kind of thing where you're trying to keep some of that kind of feel to it at all, or some way to make it so it's not like perfect CG, but it's so that the people kind of like the original, like that kind of aspect of it?
The two don't mix.
Oh, okay.
That stop motion worked because that was the way of putting over the mythological creatures and things. Right. We don't. We've replaced stop motion by visual effects.
At the same time, as a follow-up, things like Mr. Fleming's makeup, that looked very practical and aesthetic. It was great to see the real animatronic serpent produce a head rig. How important is it to use practical effects in camera whenever possible as opposed to CGI?
For us as a group of filmmakers, it's hugely important. And our visual effects supervisor, Nick Davis, the last thing he and I did together was The Dark Knight. And yet again, on that movie, we did as much as we could in camera. So there was a kind of a seamless blend. And absolutely obvious, we can't make a Kraken. You know, we can't do. There are certain things that have to be within the realm of the digital. But where we can, we're using practical effects. So our practical effects supervisor Neil Corbold, who did Black Hawk Down, he and I did Blood Diamond together. You know, he's a solid special effects operator. So in addressing how we were going to do a piece of action or an effect, it's very much, right, okay, we can go both ways here. Which way do we go? And we've gone for what would be visually the most effective. So the things that we knew would have to be digital, we've done digitally, but at the same time, various component parts of them we've done for real, so that the blend through for the audience isn't just obvious, you know?
How do you represent Mount Olympus and the home of the gods?
With a twist.
Is it a very physical place, though, that we can get to, or is it, I mean, they're definitely separate from...
They're in the heavens, very much so, yeah.
So technologically, I understand why this was time to do this. Is there anything narratively that you think makes this a sort of contemporary spin on the film?
Yeah, without a doubt. And I think that was one of the driving forces, again, for the studio going, hold on, we can see there's a good thing here. You know, Perseus is a demigod, so he's struggling with both being a human and being a god, and all kids growing up struggle with that. Not godliness, but that whole sense of, well, who am I? It's a question we've all asked ourselves and where we sit in it. And also the movie has a strong sense of destiny and fate, which has long intrigued the human race as to whether we are destined to do something or not. And it also follows him through, you know, we start, as in the original, as a baby, and we follow him through to being a man. So there's a life journey. So you've got the life journey, you've got destiny and fate, you've got the whole thing of God's influencing life as well, and they're all strands that play here. Now you put that into a contemporary groove against this backdrop and you've got something quite interesting there.
But is there something sort of 2009-2010 about the psychology of it, or about...
If you could explain to me what the psychology of 2009-2010 is, I could answer the question.
I mean, Greek mythology, it's a way of dealing with, you know, contemporary, you know, the point of mythology is it's allegorical. About telling stories at the time, and so my question is there, in the story that you're telling, is there something 2009-2010 that couldn't have been 1980-1981?
It's a good intellectual question. My argument would be to that was that in the sense that mythology and saga has a life because it deals with humanist traits and human questions through history, we merely segue with that thrust. There is no moment within this film that locks it into 9/11 or a world economic crash. We're picking up on all the human traits. You've got to bear in mind too that this is a work that has a PG-13, so we have to, within it, and one of the great things with mythology is that good and bad kind of has a white hat, black hat thing going on, and people coming to the cinema kind of know generally where they're going. They haven't got to pick up a cut or a thrust within it. And we, by going that route, inherently, with Clash of the Titans or any of these Greek mythology things, the audience know that. The joy of it is in the exposition, not in the initial education.
What's the X factor that movie brings to this production?
He's got a handle on... What's interesting is the way he sees a scene and then executes the scene. The camera's always moving. The camera is probing and finding. It's not not so much a static camera, it's very dynamic. So I think you saw from that Scissor Reel, we're constantly moving and finding things, and shots are always progressing and always developing. So I think this movie will have great pace. And I think that's what he's going to bring to it. You know, we know the characters, but the way he lets them unfold within a scene and the pace and the energy of it is what's going to... This is not going to be a passive film. It's going to have a beat. And I think, you know, one of the things that this film will very much benefit from is that scoring and those sound effects. What noise does a Medusa make? It will be more complex than just a rattlesnake over. Do you know what I mean? We have a whole world with creatures that have noises coming in, which will help boost this. And I think that's what he's going to bring to it.
Well, speaking of creatures, one of the things that makes the original Clash of the Titans really kind of great is that the creatures aren't just sort of throwaway things. They're characters in their own right. I mean, is that something you guys are
very much so.
Having them be?
Very, very much so, yeah. Yeah, they're not just going to be an effect. There's interplay between them as well. And we've done some good, great stuff with the Medusa, specifically in relation to that.
Will there be both Minotaurs and Centaurs in this movie?
We have to leave some things here.
One of the things about the original movie, that also, you have these great actors, and this one too, you have these great actors, and you have the scenes with the gods just talking.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you haven't done the edit yet, but do you know how much of that actual like exposition that will still leave in, or is it going to be like some serious like all action, or I mean, you still leave some of that?
Well, one's a counterpoint to the other, so there's clearly going to be both. But one of the interesting things of post-production is the balance of a movie. You know, you can swing it in the emphasis, and you know, we've got considerable latitude there. So
Do you have any idea? Like, you have these great actors, you come to a lot of great dramatic moments. Do you feel like you're still able to leave a lot of that in, or do you feel like you have to keep it moving and try to make it move?
Well, they actually, although they're not of action being gods so much, they drive the plot along. So that balance, yeah, we'll oscillate, as in the original, from up on high to down below, and then down there. So there's all that to bear in mind.
The original was interesting because you have great actors coming in, and you get the sense that these, you know, Laurence Olivier and everybody, they're having fun with these roles. What sort of is the tone of this? Because there's a lot of fun in the original Clash of Titans. This is one of these modern, grim and gritty things, or is there like that ton of fun as well?
There is fun as well, yeah. There has to be. I mean, you know, it has to have broad appeal. We're not doing an R-rated Clash of the Titans, which, you know, there'd be no value in that. So yeah, the fun element is there.
So there's humor to it as well.
I have a question. You said that one, it would be PG-13, and two, that it's very black and white, you know, good, bad. But the, you know, the thing about the gods themselves is that they are very gray, and in fact, Zeus raped the queen to conceive Perseus. So how is that going to be?
Yeah, when I said it's very black and white, I said, you know, going in, that there is black and white. I'm not saying this film is black and white. So, yeah, the great thing with storytelling of this level, where you have to appeal to children who do not know what Clash of the Titans is, and generations who've consumed the previous Clash of the Titans, and generations prior to that who were familiar with mythology through classical education, is that's a fairly broad spectrum audience. And so... with the mythology and the way we're handling it, that some of the darker stories, you know, the rape of Danae becoming the Medusa, it's there, but it's not there in... It's not a history lesson. Do you see what I mean? It's not explicit, because I think when you start going down those roads, it's a lot of screen time telling something, and, you know, for your 13-year-old child, it's raising a lot of questions. They're going to get lost in that. So we're striking a balance between all of this.
I have a mental image of everybody in pre-production walking around with a copy of Bill Finch's Mythology and like highlighting their favorite bits. I mean, was there a learning curve for everyone? Did anyone come up and go, can we do this bit here from, you know?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that happened when we were prepping the film in LA with the writers as to which bits, because I think one of the great problems with something like this is sometimes less is more. There are so many good bits, and it goes back to your point, would there be another? Well, the answer is you're like in a well-stocked kitchen, do you know what I mean? You know, sometimes the best dish is a little bit of something, there's an awful lot left on the shelf, and I think, yeah, we have to be very careful to not to over-egg our cake, because yes, there are these great characters, and you start to research one character and you come across another one and you think, well, how about that? And I think, you know, diligence was done early on, and we have to keep it into a size because you're right, there's just so many characters that you could put in there, you know, and might.
I'm curious, what's the most time you spent on one of these film obviously has a lot of action. What's the most shooting you've done on what's the biggest action sequence?
Almost time. See that? I have to come back to you with another question. This end sequence that's out here, the set you'll see here, has an awful lot of time spent on it, but a lot of it in post-production because it involves a kraken. If you're just referring to shooting time.
Well, I mean, I guess both.
Probably the end sequence will probably have the most time spent in the three-dimensional visual effects world, and then the battle we have with our scorpions took a lot of time because we chose a location that was at just over 9,000 feet up a volcano in Tenerife, and our hotel was a beachfront hotel, so every morning 300 good men and true, as it were, the crew got into the minibuses and we drove up these switchback roads through the pines, then into the base of the clouds, then we came out the top of the clouds, and then we drove into this national park, and then we parked, then we got into minibuses and travelled, and then we got to our desert location, which was pretty spectacular. You saw some of the shots in the trailer coming up through the clouds. We were above the cloud ceiling. Most people talk about the cloud base, and then we drove through that. And then we shot our movie in thin air, because at that point, people were having altitude sickness and all those sort of things. And then at the end of the day, back down we came. So we were losing 3 hours a day just getting our asses from A to B. And everything had to go up. Your yogurt, your milk, your bread, your bun, your bacon, your all of that. So that whole thing was like a 2 or 3 week run to get that sequence.
Well, even this is, the film is obviously a very large budget. Obviously, you have to make sacrifices and considerations of where you want to spend your money. In the pre-production process, were you guys already saying we definitely are going to, you know, allocate a certain, you know, this is where we want to spend the cash?
Yeah, that is, for me, that is pre-production. I get a script and sit and talk to the director and get a handle on his vision, and then you have to say, okay, well, you know, there's a great degree of passion about this, but there's not a great degree. That's kind of like ancillary. So we'll have to look at this to do that. And then we look at the look of the film and where the director wants to go. And that then has a price tag. And that's where I spent a lot of time with my early crew, 4 or 5 of us in production, melding this thing. I'm going to the director and saying, well, look, that may have to go because this is really worth it. And that's the balance of the film. And early pre-production, what makes a good movie is the focus there. Making decisions and sticking to them has always been the big issues, like Braveheart, where we said, okay, we're going to do this and it's going to be down, it's going to be dirty, and where's the base camp? Well, it's going to be 3 miles that way. And Mel's saying, well, what are you going to do with the actors? And I said, well, if you don't have a trailer here, they won't need a trailer here. He said, you're absolutely right. And we got him a site hut, like one of these brown things out here, and that was the trailer. But that decision, made really, really early on, set the tone for the movie. So those formative months before the movie's, in effect, greenlit, really is the base rock of your pyramid. And the bit that the audience can see is just that little bit at the top. All of this that stops the thing falling over, that gives it shape and gives it form, are those decisions. And we made those very, very key ones before we started our official pre-production. We made a decision that we would be going into Tenerife, but no one had filmed there since 1969.
What was filmed there in 1969?
Raquel Welsh, 1 million BC. But so, one of the things we wanted to do was not give another slice of Morocco, where most times you go and there's the gaffer tape from the previous unit. Do you know what I mean? We wanted to give something new so that our story had a degree of verisimilitude. Our story was in a new world. Our story was showing things that were new as much as one can when you have to have, you know, 300 people in hotels. So those decisions were made very, very early on. Ethiopia was tagged early on, and Carl has been sorting, associate producer, he's been sorting out Ethiopia because we're going into an area where it's 54 degrees, it's the hottest place on earth, it's a war zone, we have to helicopter everything in, and it's tricky filming. But we knew, visually, it will be spectacular.
Still easier than shooting in Manhattan.
I'm sorry?
It's still easier than shooting in Manhattan, sure.
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah.
You mentioned 300 now, a couple. I wasn't going to bring it up, but you mentioned 300 twice now. You've got a March release, same studio, Ancient Greece. How are you going to differentiate this to people who wake up on a Friday and decide what movie they're going to go to? How are they going to know if this is not...
Well, the marketing, obviously. I mean, you know, I love this thing with you know, dates. Do you know what I mean? That was a panhole date until the 300 came out, and it made money. Now it's the 300 date. I mean, the two things are not inherently linked if you'd studied any form of economics. And I think that that's the answer to the question. Do you know what I mean? It's nonsense. I mean, the film will stand on its own 2 feet, you know, as one thing, as it did, you know. And our marketing, the word that you guys put out, the feel for it, our teasers, our trailers, and all of that, it will have a life independent of, you know.
Do you think there's something sort of reductive that studios do in terms of where they decide, okay, this worked in March, therefore this is a March movie, or do you think that there's a difference in terms of what might work in March versus in June?
It's a body of knowledge to which I'm consumptive as opposed to authorial, I don't know.
Well, I want to talk about the broad spectrum of people who is, you know, trying to appeal to, like, the young kids and the, you know, the older kids. I was curious about how is the, I don't know about how the original movie played, but I know some movies play better in the States and better internationally or Europe. It seems like it could play both places. I mean, you guys have looked into that as far as...
Yeah, I mean, I think in the curriculum of education in the United States, Greek mythology is not as dominant as it is in European education. Do you see what I mean? So clearly there's an international swath here. But at the same time, as we said earlier, a lot of the traits of mythology are humanist. And, you know, mythology, dragons, Medusas is cool shit. No matter what your culture, it's like, fuck, that's great. So that will work. So I think a film like this will work at different levels in different markets. And I think because it's not solely segmental, then its international appeal, I think, will be quite wide, but I think it will be cool stuff for a domestic market as well.
Yeah, I was curious about this, because I know when I was younger, I was in my 40s, so I was into mythology, but I'm not sure my kids today, whether or not they have the same kind of...
Yeah, but I mean, I think most people have said the same of magic until Potter came along, or pirates until Johnny did his skit. You know what I mean? I think the thing is that, you know, a story well told stands up, and I think, you know, one of the important things in... For me, doing the movies that I've done, I've loved movies that didn't follow, that made fresh tracks, that wanted to go, that movies that were hard to get off the ground, movies that you had to kick some butt and you took risks on, were for me the more enjoyable ones, the rebellious directors, do you know what I mean, who had a great vision and said, fuck it, I'm going to do it. Those movies are great because it's very easy to mass produce mediocrity. It's very, very difficult to be bold and go and do something new.
So Sam could not be any more different than Harry Hamlin. So how different, what is the difference between this Perseus and the Perseus that we know from the 80s? How different is this character?
Well, I think we briefly touched on this. You know, he's more contemporary, he's more savvy. The Harry Hamlin character kind of worked then, because we got Warren Beatty with his helmet hair, and that worked. That doesn't work anymore. In fact, it only works, you know, if you're Owen Wilson. Do you know what I mean? That you can do, because it's gone from the realm of profundity to comedy. And so we've now got this character inhabited as much more visceral and as much more practical and suffers injury and things like this. That's one facet of the way it's being played, yeah. I mean, don't forget, you've seen the sizzle, really. This was something we wanted to, because it's a remake, because it's Clash of the Titans, one of our decisions that Basil, myself, and Louis, the producer and director, made was that we were going to and wanted to give you guys greater access than a lot of movies. Do you know what I mean? I've never done as much access of my own design, as it were, because this is a film where we don't, a straight comparison is really not what this film's about. It's not what we set out to do. We didn't sit down and, you know, have we got a scorpion? Check. Have we got a, do you know, we never approached it that way. We've sort of gone back in and ours is going to be a fresher look at it. And I think the way he's playing it is a fresher look. There's a lot of discussion of, well, in this situation, how much would the force of the gods influence this, rather than, you know, we've reached a narrative end, let's cut to Burgess Meredith by the gods, there's the sword. That wasn't deemed for us, you know.
I know they're like wrapping up right now, but we'll ask a quick question. In the original, you know, he first goes with all these guys to have an adventure, and I don't know who any of those guys are in the original. Here I'm seeing characters that are differentiated, that seem to be different characters. Is that sort of a big thing here, that this group he's with, they are characters?
Yeah, cannon fodder doesn't work for us. They're all characters with traits, with contributions to make, with their own curious habits. So the group, when Perseus goes off on this voyage journey, the interplay of the personalities is core to that journey and plays its way out with the creatures we meet.
In the U.S., last question, in the U.S., we do have psychotic fundamentalist Christians that might
really
freak out that this is a polytheistic film. You might find yourself on the other end of a boycott, believe it or not. Have you thought about that at all? Has this entered your mind?
We're working on the theory that enough of them will buy tickets to have an opinion. I don't think so.
You never know.
I mean, yeah, but if they do, then I think it will be indicative to the rest of the world how their eyes aren't on contemporary politics worldwide.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Sorry. Thanks.
Okay, go come to the bathroom.